Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, and this episode, on Thursday, May 22nd, 2025, will feature articles that appeared in the Arizona Mirror over the past week. Since this program airs only once a week, some of the articles may be a bit dated, and breaking stories may be added toward the end. The Arizona Mirror is an independent publication which sources stories from all over the state and the nation. We will focus primarily on stories that impact people in Arizona. In this week's episode, these are some of the stories we'll be reading. Maricopa County poised to hire a national consulting firm for review of election procedures. Two secretaries of state unpacked the lessons of proof of citizenship laws for voting. After Hub signs Axon carve-out bill, opposition group plans multi-pronged response. Nothing to be surprised about. Governor's office responds to Horn's anti-trans bill complaints. Arizona joins growing list of states requiring ID for online porn access. But first, we turn to a commentary. Lawmakers should consider these questions before giving a billionaire a stadium bailout. Should taxpayers subsidize a billionaire team owner while schools and public safety face budget cuts? By Melinda Iyer, May 19, 2025. Melinda Iyer is one of the co-founders of Save Our Schools Arizona, an all-volunteer, community-based, nonpartisan advocacy and outreach group dedicated to supporting public education and tax dollar accountability in education. Behind closed doors, some of our state politicians are busy negotiating to force Arizona taxpayers to fork over up to $1 billion of our hard-earned taxes. This would redirect public resources to subsidize a lucrative private sports franchise and its billionaire owner, and that raises more questions than answers. Why do billionaires deserve handouts? Arizona Diamondbacks team owner Ken Kendrick is rich enough to build several stadiums without any taxpayer handout. The team is valued at $1.6 billion, having appreciated almost sevenfold since he bought it in 2004. As one economist says, the harsh reality for even the biggest sports fan is that arena subsidies are a terrible use of finite government resources and a ridiculously egregious redistribution of wealth from regular Americans to some of the wealthiest people and organizations on the planet. These are simply not people and organizations that need taxpayer help. How would lawmakers justify the cost to taxpayers? The entire premise of this idea is that it only takes public tax resources from people who use the stadium, but that is simply false. With the stadium giveaway, lawmakers are considering the state of Arizona, Maricopa County, and the city of Phoenix would all lose tax dollars that currently help pay for things like schools and public safety. State and local budgets are already strained due to the spiraling cost of Arizona's massive tax cuts and out-of-control universal vouchers. Faced with dwindling state-shared revenues, the city of Phoenix was recently forced to raise its sales tax to avoid cuts to police, fires, and libraries. Where would the money come from? Combined Arizona state, county, and city sales taxes are already among the highest in the country. Our burden ranks 11th nationwide, and it's rising. Arizona also ranks 8th lowest in the country for investment per capita, meaning our needs are vast. Finding extra public revenue to prop up the billionaire owner of a lucrative franchise means either allowing that vast list of needs to accumulate as Arizonans go without, or tapping into taxpayers' pockets in the form of tax increases? Are stadium subsidies a good investment? Evidence from a wide swath of economists show that arena giveaways are a drain, not a boon. More than three decades of studies have found stadiums to be consistent money pits, unjustified as worthwhile public investments because the promised financial benefits fail to materialize. Proponents argue that if the Diamondbacks are not playing at Chase Field, there is no revenue generated at all. But this economic fallacy ignores the fact that most spending at a stadium is a substitute for other local recreational spending. We're simply shuffling the economic deck chairs by pulling commerce from elsewhere nearby. Our taxpayer dollars could be diverted to luxury amenities or to tax-exempt hotels, restaurants, bars, and retail, with little hope of public benefit. Why should taxpayers subsidize luxury amenities and tax-exempt private pockets? How would proponents of a stadium giveaway ensure taxpayer accountability and prevent misuse of public resources? What about the lawsuit settlement? In 2017, just 19 years after taxpayers paid more than $250 million to help build the ballpark, team owner Ken Kendrick sued Maricopa County for refusing to pay $187 million for renovations. He eventually agreed to take proceeds from stadium maintenance and event bookings to pay for his desired upgrades, an agreement intended to protect taxpayers. That lawsuit settlement explicitly released the county from further financial obligations. Now the team has come to the state capitol with both hands out, asking for even more taxpayer money. Did the team's management fail to adequately budget for expected renovations? And if so, why should taxpayers step in to save them from their lack of financial planning? Where else would the team go? A frequently heard argument is that we have to pay up or the team will punish us by decamping for a more lucrative pasture. But where is that exactly? With 5 million residents, Phoenix is the 10th largest metro area in the nation. All comparably sized markets in the United States already have their own teams. The team would have to relocate to Montreal or Mexico City to avoid downgrading. The current 30-team league also has two expansion teams shopping for a location, further complicating any move. Perhaps this is why, at a recent closed-door meeting, a team rep insinuated or threatened that Major League Baseball would pull spring training from Arizona, relocating the 15 teams that call the Cactus League their spring home if lawmakers don't use tax money to pay for the stadium upgrades. Can you say quid pro quo? There's a glaring potential conflict of interest here, too. Kendrick and his wife Randy are key political donors who spent nearly $1 million in 2024 to influence control of the Arizona legislature, including funding independent expenditures to support Jeff Weiniger, a Republican from Chandler, and directly oppose his opponent. Just months after his win, Weiniger sponsored the Diamondbacks Stadium Funding Bill and advanced it through the committee he chairs. This looks for all the world like, quote, pay to play, which raises eyebrows and serious ethical concerns. What else could we do with $1 billion? Stadium subsidies impose an invisible burden on taxpayers in the form of foregone public services like police and fire services, parks, schools, libraries, roads, and public transit. The opportunity costs of these missed expenditures are critically important to our communities. Why hand that money over to a billionaire-owned pro sports team? What if lawmakers choose to put this to voters? Asking taxpayers whether we want to subsidize a multi-billion-dollar private corporation and its billionaire owner instead of forcing the giveaway down our throats behind closed doors would probably produce a decisive answer. And that's why the team and legislators don't want to go to the ballot. Voters across the nation have clearly shown they don't like stadium giveaways. In the last 2 years alone, voters have axed a Virginia subsidy amid fierce public opposition, vetoed a stadium handout in Kansas City, and decisively rejected a taxpayer-financed arena right here at home. Arizonans deserve good tax policy that benefits the entire state, not just the wealthy, and embraces the spirit of public benefit. We encourage Governor Katie Hobbs and state lawmakers to consider all the above questions before making a decision that will weigh on taxpayers for decades to come. And that concludes this first item, which again was a commentary. Lawmakers should consider these questions before giving a billionaire a stadium bailout. Next up, Maricopa County poised to hire national consulting firm for review of election procedures by Jen Fifield of VoteBeat, May 20th, 2025. Maricopa County supervisors are poised to award a national consulting firm a $400,000 contract for another review of the county's often scrutinized election procedures. County procurement staff is recommending that the supervisors vote Wednesday to award the contract to Barry Dunn, an accounting and consulting firm that has examined Maricopa's election procedures in the past. The year-long review will cover six main processes, but won't include a look at past election results. Supervisors Chairman Thomas Galvin has repeatedly made a point to differentiate this review from the controversial, quote, audit of Maricopa County's 2020 election results commissioned by top Republicans in the state Senate. There will be no cyber ninjas here, Galvin said in January, referring to the company Republican leaders hired for that review, adding, we are going to look at reputable companies. Six other companies also bid for the contract, according to a county spokesperson. The Republican-led board announced in January that they wanted a contractor to examine how the giant county could improve the way it runs elections for its 2.6 million voters. New supervisors who ran on a platform of, quote, election integrity, said that after years of scrutiny and unproven theories about widespread fraud, they wanted to ensure themselves that the county was running secure and efficient elections. Galvin stressed at the time that he wanted to hire a contractor who actually has expertise in the field. He didn't immediately respond to a request for comment on why Barry Dunn was chosen. Barry Dunn has done election consulting work for Maricopa County before, in 2018 and 2021, although it appears most of its government contracting work doesn't involve elections. Barry Dunn conducted an audit of Adrian Fontes' Election Day procedures in 2018 when Fontes was Maricopa County Recorder, after technical issues setting up polling places that year caused many locations to open late. In 2021, it reviewed the county's procurement process for selecting Dominion voting systems. In both instances, it recommended procedures to improve the systems. The supervisors want the new review focused on six areas: chain of custody for ballots and other supplies and documents, physical safety, candidate filing compliance, temporary worker hiring and training, ballot drop boxes, and vote center selection and setup. This will include a review of processes that have come under criticism over the last few elections, including the tracking procedures for the county's paper ballots, background checks for temporary workers, and ballot pickup, auditing, and tamper prevention at the county's drop boxes. And that concludes this story, Maricopa County poised to hire a national consulting firm for review of election procedures. Next up, two secretaries of state unpacked the lessons of proof of citizenship laws for voting. In a conversation with VoteBeat, Arizona's Adrian Fontes and New Hampshire's David Scanlon share what their states are learning about the policy and what others should understand. By Jessica Huseman of VoteBeat. The conversation was recorded by Jen Fifield of VoteBeat. This week, VoteBeat had a chance to sit down with Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes and New Hampshire Secretary of State David Scanlon to discuss one of the most contentious topics in election administration today, laws that require voters to show documentary proof of their U.S. citizenship. Fontes is a Democrat and Scanlon is a Republican. They are charged with overseeing elections in very different states, but they frequently found common ground while discussing whether these laws are necessary, how they affect voters, and what happens when policy is driven by perception rather than reality. A national debate shaped by realities. Arizona has had a documentary proof of citizenship requirement to vote in state and local elections in place since 2004. In New Hampshire, a law requiring citizenship proof for anyone registering to vote went into force before local elections earlier this year. Many more states are considering adding requirements to voter registration to keep non-citizens off the voter rolls. Congress is considering the SAVE Act, legislation to require citizenship proof nationwide, and President Donald Trump in March issued an executive order mandating it, though a federal court has blocked his directive. For Fontes, who is skeptical of such laws, the motive behind them is clear. The willingness of some folks to try to bend a political narrative that is not based in fact in order to attain or retain political power. He stresses that cases of non-citizen casting ballots are exceedingly rare. There are onesies, twosies, incidents where people make attempts to vote as non-citizens, Fontes said, but it doesn't happen at scale. The idea that the system needs to be upended to address this rare problem, he added, seems a little tail wagging the dog. Scanlon acknowledged that non-citizen voting is rare, but offered a more nuanced view of the case for proof of citizenship requirements, stressing the need for balance. Everyone who is qualified should be able to exercise that right without a lot of difficulty, he said. But voters also have the right to know who else is participating in that election and that those individuals are qualified. The tension between those two principles, access and integrity, is where Scanlon sees the challenge. In the extremes, if you make it too hard to register to vote, you are creating a situation where voter suppression can exist, he said. Added burdens for voters and states. Both secretaries raised concerns about the impact documentary proof of citizenship laws can have on voters who may struggle to navigate them. Scanlon cited examples from his own state's experience in this year's local elections. A small group of voters showed up without documentation. Most returned later with the required paperwork, but there were some who just left and never came back. That tells me that we know there is a population out there that is going to need some help, he said, and that has to come in two forms: robust voter education and direct assistance in obtaining documents. Fontes went a step further with his caveats, asked what advice he'd have to other states considering similar laws. He'd say, first, don't do it. It's a bad idea. It's understandable for voters to be concerned about non-citizens voting potentially diluting their political power, Fontes said, but the facts don't back up the fear. If I knew someone was taking some of my power away, I would be upset too, he said, but I haven't seen any evidence that this is happening. Both of them cautioned that states determined to implement proof of citizenship requirements should expect to spend plenty of time and money on making the system work. Educating voters on new processes is hard, and so is retraining every poll worker. We're tinkering around with a fundamental right here, Fontes said. It's going to be a tough ride. What comes next? The conversation didn't offer tidy solutions, but it did something arguably more important. It acknowledged the nuance, the trade-offs, and the very real impact these laws can have on voters. Fontes closed with a warning. Massive changes to solve a tiny problem? That's not good governance. Scanlon, more measured, said the responsibility falls on election officials to make sure the system works for everyone, including those who might otherwise be left behind. As more states consider implementing documentary proof of citizenship laws, the lessons from Arizona and New Hampshire are becoming clearer. Context matters, execution matters more, and trust, well, that's really what's at stake. And that concludes this story. Two secretaries of state unpack the lessons of proof of citizenship laws for voting. Coming up next, after Hobbs signs Axon carve-out bill, opposition group plans multi-pronged response. Opponents have filed for a statewide referendum while pursuing legal options against the Scottsdale HQ and apartment project. By Jared McDonald Evoy, May 16, 2025. After a contentious battle at the legislature and a signature by Governor Katie Hobbs to create a legal carve-out, those opposed to law enforcement technology company Axon's planned massive headquarters and housing project are looking at all their options, including asking Arizona voters to repeal the new law. But whether that 2026 ballot measure happens remains to be seen. We're not prepared to say which way we are going to go yet. Bob Littlefield, a former Scottsdale City Councilman who's been at the head of efforts to lead a local referendum vote against the project, told the Arizona Mirror, "We are going to keep our options open." Littlefield is part of a group called Taxpayers Against Awful Apartment Zoning Exemptions, or TAAZE, TAZE, for short, which led the charge to gather signatures to hold a referendum on the project in Scottsdale. The Arizona Constitution gives residents the right to refer matters to the ballot. Axon came to the Capitol in 2025, aiming to bar voters in every city and town in Arizona from being able to challenge zoning and development decisions, like the one TAZE mounted in Scottsdale. But when that bill failed to garner enough support, the company and its allies pivoted instead to merely stripping away the right of Scottsdale voters to challenge the police weapons manufacturer's HQ project near Hayden Road and the Loop 101. In addition to the firm's international headquarters, the project will include a luxury hotel and roughly 1,900 apartments, some of which will be offered to Axon employees at discounted costs. Last month, Governor Katie Hobbs gave Axon what it wanted, signing into law the legislation that cancels the referendum vote. I think this is pretty clear. These guys want their apartments. They don't care what Scottsdale residents think, Littlefield said. They made it pretty clear who they are and what they're going to do, so I think it's up to us to do whatever we can to thwart that. TAZE has now filed paperwork with the Secretary of State's office for a statewide referendum on that legislation, but Littlefield said it's just one option that his group is looking at pursuing. We believe we have the law on our side. We believe this bill is a special interest gift, which is illegal, Littlefield said. The opposition group is likely to file a legal challenge soon, and TAZE is also supportive of legal steps being taken by the city of Scottsdale, which opposed the bill as well. We think we can beat this in court, he said. The new law says that any municipality with between 200,000 and 500,000 residents, Scottsdale had 241 residents in the 2020 census, must, quote, allow hotel use and multifamily residential housing for land zoned like the Axon parcel, without requiring any type of application that will require a public hearing if certain criteria is met. If the statewide referendum is to happen, TASE would need to gather 127,975 signatures in order to qualify for the 2026 ballot, but it cannot begin doing so until the legislative session ends, and it must collect all the signatures within 90 days. Littlefield said he is confident that the group will be able to meet that challenge if needed, though it won't be easy to go head-to-head against an opponent worth over $50 billion. In Scottsdale, TASE was able to use dark money to hide the source of the funds that paid for more than 90% of the signatures they gathered. Exxon spokesman David Leibowitz said in a statement to the Arizona Mirror, "Since that won't be the case at the state level, we look forward to seeing who's funding their campaign, especially given that a statewide signature effort will likely cost more than $2 million. Leibowitz added that Exxon will vigorously defend the project, which the company says will create 5,500 jobs and have more than $4 billion in economic impact. Local activists, backed by a signature-gathering effort linked to a California labor union, gathered more than 25,000 signatures to send the rezoning decision made by a lame duck city council. The votes for the project came from councilors who had been voted out of office to the ballot in a voter referendum, which must happen by November 2026. Littlefield shot back at Leibowitz's remarks, citing their own campaign finance reports. "You can see our campaign finance report. All our stuff is disclosed," Littlefield said. "Axon's been lying their way through this, and to call us liars, that's kind of hilarious, actually." The sponsor of the Exxon legislation, Representative Tony Rivero, a Republican from Peoria, did not respond to requests for comment. And that concludes this update. After Hobbs signs Exxon carve-out bill, opposition group plans multi-pronged response. Our next story, nothing to be surprised about. Governor's office responds to Horn's anti-trans bill complaints. By Caitlin Severs, May 15, 2025. The head of Arizona's public schools said he was surprised that the governor vetoed two pieces of anti-trans legislation that he claimed were common sense and would protect girls and parental rights, even though she's vetoed every measure Republicans have sent her that targeted transgender people. And Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs already vetoed nearly identical legislation last year. It's surprising to me that the governor did not recognize the legislation's value in promoting common sense, girls' privacy, safety, and the rights of parents to be fully informed about what their children are doing while at school or related activities, Republican Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn said in a written statement. On May 12th, Hobbs vetoed Senate Bill 1002 and Senate Bill 1003, both sponsored by Fountain Hills Republican Senator John Kavanaugh, who has introduced numerous anti-trans bills over the past decade, including bills that mirror the ones that Hobbs vetoed this week. Senate Bill 1002 would have banned teachers from referring to a student by a name or pronoun that differs from their given name or biological sex without first obtaining written permission from a parent. Senate Bill 1003 would have barred trans students from using locker rooms and bathrooms that don't match their biological sex. It would also ban trans students from staying in the same room as classmates or teammates of the opposite biological sex on school trips. Hobbs vetoed both proposals alongside numerous others on May 12th and wrote in her veto letters that they would not increase opportunity, security, or freedom for Arizonans. In response to Horn's statement, Hobbs spokesman Christian Slater told the Arizona Mirror there's nothing to be surprised about. Governor Hobbs has made clear time and again that she is focused on increasing opportunity, security, and freedom for Arizonans, he said. These bills do not do that. Instead of sending the same bill every year, only to be vetoed, the legislature should work with the governor to lower costs, protect the border, create jobs, and secure Arizona's water future. During a March 25th committee hearing, Kavanaugh claimed that SB 1003 would balance cisgender students' desire for privacy with trans students' discomfort using facilities that don't align with their gender identity. He claimed it would do so by allowing trans students to request other accommodations, such as the use of single occupancy or staff bathrooms. But Paul Bixler, a transgender woman and advocate, told the committee that the proposal would create an atmosphere of exclusion, alienation, and disenfranchisement. In a May 12 statement, Kavanaugh accused Hobbs of vetoing the bill as a way to pander to the extremist liberal community and claimed that it would expose children to sexual violence, harassment, and emotional distress. A 13-year-old female should not be forced to stand next to a naked transgender female who is in reality an 18-year-old biological male, Kavanaugh said. The fact that this bill was vetoed proves just how little Hobbs cares for the development of our youth and how radical she is for Arizona. But there's no evidence that allowing transgender people to use bathrooms that align with their gender identity leads to an increase in sexual assaults. In fact, the opposite may be true. Surveys have shown that banning transgender people from using bathrooms that align with their identities puts them at greater risk of being assaulted. In his statement, Horn argued that girls deserve locker rooms and restrooms that aren't accessible to biological males. Public schools are entrusted to educate children, not to interfere with the rights of parents to raise their children as they see fit, Horn said. This veto is contrary to overwhelming public support for protecting girls and parental rights. Public support for restrictions on things like participation in sports teams that align with their gender identities and for gender-affirming care for minors has increased in the past few years as Republicans, led by President Donald Trump, continue their attacks on transgender people. A poll conducted last month by the 19th, a nonprofit newsroom covering gender and public policy, found that 49% of Americans think politicians should not be focusing on transgender issues at all. And with that, we conclude this story. Nothing to be surprised about. Governor's office responds to Horn's anti-trans bill complaints. You're listening to the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week at this time by Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster. Next up, Arizona joins growing list of states requiring ID for online porn access. By Jared McDonald Evoy, May 14, 2025. Governor Katie Hobbs signed legislation that will require Arizonans to prove they are at least 18 years old before accessing online pornography by either submitting a government-issued ID or using an age verification system that relies on, quote, transactional data. The bill, run by freshman Republican lawmaker Nick Cupper, a Republican from Surprise, is similar to legislation Republicans have pushed in previous years that failed to gain support due to constitutional concerns. Cupper's House Bill 2112 is similar to efforts to crack down on pornography access in other states, such as Louisiana and Texas, and he cited Texas law as the inspiration for his legislation. Lobbyists representing the adult entertainment industry and the American Civil Liberties Union have voiced concerns that the bill's language could loop in non-pornographic material and would do little to prevent children from seeing pornographic content. They added that it could push users to black market sites outside of the United States where child sex abuse material or other malicious material may reside. The industry has been advocating for device-level solutions that are backed by organizations such as the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which has also voiced concerns with laws like the one Cupper has proposed. Cupper celebrated Hobbs' signing of the bill. Hardcore pornography has just been one click away from kids for too long, and the companies behind it have looked the other way while cashing in. This law forces them to take responsibility and keeps miners off their platforms, Cupper said in a written statement. The law also allows for lawsuits to be brought against websites if they do not comply with the law. They can face fines of up to $10,000 for each day they are in noncompliance. Other states that have implemented age verification have seen the use of virtual private networks skyrocket, and the popularity of more illicit sites growing in popularity as legitimate website operators have been working to block IP addresses from those states. Cupper has previously expressed doubts that a child could use a VPN or other means to get around the age verification system. Groups like the ACLU have voiced their concerns that the law could be weaponized to block minors from accessing websites that have information about sex but aren't pornographic, including websites dedicated to HIV/AIDS, sex education, and the LGBTQ community. Cupper has shot back at that criticism, saying the bill is aimed at content that is, as the bill states, is patently offensive with respect to minors and depicts sexual acts and lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. This isn't Arizona's first time trying to change state law to keep juveniles from accessing online pornography. In 2000, lawmakers extended the harmful to minors statute to include the internet, but it was later struck down as unconstitutional. Other states that have enacted similar laws are facing legal challenges, and tech behemoths are fighting over the exact future of how these types of bills will play out. The bill passed out of both chambers largely along party lines, with only one Democrat in the Senate, Kiana Sears, and two in the House, where Seth Blatman and Kevin Vogt voted to pass it. And that concludes this story. Arizona joins growing list of states requiring ID for online porn access. Our next story, Republican legislators call for more solutions to the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis, by Shondine Silversmith, May 21, 2025. Two of Arizona's Republican legislators are urging state and federal lawmakers to unite and work on solutions to address the ongoing crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, following the recent signing of a bill that will create a turquoise alert system for missing Native people, a significant state legislative action, the lawmakers emphasized the importance of maintaining momentum. Missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, also known as MMIP, is an ongoing issue within Indigenous communities across the country, with Indigenous peoples at the forefront of efforts to raise awareness about the crisis and to push for action. Representative Walt Blackman, a Republican from Snowflake, emphasized that their efforts are not just about policy, but about the people, lives, and families who have been deeply affected by the crisis. In some tribal communities, Indigenous women face murder rates that are more than 10 times the national average, according to the Department of Justice. In 2017, homicide was reported as the fourth leading cause of death among Indigenous women and girls between the ages of 1 and 19 years old, and the sixth leading cause of death for ages 20 to 44, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In a report from the National Institute of Justice, 84% of Indigenous women experience violence in their lifetime, compared to 71% of white women. Blackman, who represents a district that borders the Navajo Nation, said he has heard firsthand stories of how communities have been impacted. "We need our congressional delegation to do a better job of tracking," he said, adding that the state needs more help coordinating communication among agencies when someone goes missing. Blackman said that will ensure that when an Indigenous person goes missing, it won't take as long to put out an alert. Blackman and Representative Teresa Martinez, a Republican from Casa Grande, held a press conference Tuesday at the Arizona State Capitol Rose Garden to urge action. Martinez sponsored the Turquoise Alert System Bill, House Bill 2281, which passed through the House and Senate unanimously. It creates a system that will coordinate alerts for missing indigenous or endangered persons through the federal authorized emergency alert system. The bill passed shortly after the state Senate amended the legislation to include minors who go missing. The change allows the alert system to be activated in cases like Emily Pikes, an indigenous teen whose disappearance and murder earlier this year was cited by lawmakers as the impetus for the measure. We have too much work to do to protect women and children of the state of Arizona, Martinez said. Martinez represents District 16, which includes the Gila River Indian Community and the Acheon Indian Community. She said her granddaughter is part of the Gila River Indian Community, and if she ever went missing, Martinez would turn the world upside down looking for her. We have to have that same standard for all our children, regardless of the color of their skin and where they come from, she said, adding that she is glad that more attention is being paid to the issue so that they can think of ways to find all the missing women. The MMIP crisis has persisted for generations, with many efforts to address this issue in Arizona led by indigenous women, leaders, and their supporters. Legislation has been introduced, rallies held, awareness walks organized, and various efforts have taken place over the years to highlight the ongoing MMIP crisis within indigenous communities. Arizona is reported to have the third largest number of missing and murdered indigenous women and girls in the country. That study reported 506 known cases in 71 urban areas across the country, 54 of which were in Arizona, including 31 in Tucson. In 2021, Arizona had the third largest number of unresolved missing indigenous people cases in the country, according to NAMUS, NAMUS. There are currently 91 missing indigenous people cases in the NAMUS database for Arizona. More than 10,600 indigenous people were reported missing in the U.S. in 2023, roughly 3,300 of whom were 18 or older, according to the FBI. The National Missing and Unidentified Persons System reported that more than 23,700 missing persons cases were in the database at the end of 2023, and 255 of those were for indigenous people. There is still no single database that provides accurate numbers or data related to missing and murdered indigenous peoples across the country. With no centralized database among the thousands of federal, state, and tribal entities, the information available is limited. When looking at the numbers, it's important to note that indigenous people make up only about 6% of the population in Arizona. There are only three major population areas in the state that have large indigenous populations, and each of the 22 tribal nations in Arizona has a large number of people living on the reservation. If this happened anywhere else in this state, the alarming numbers that we see, we would be on it, Blackman said. We would have laws written, we'd have green, yellow, blue alerts out, but for whatever reason, this is not being addressed appropriately. Blackman said that his and Martina's call for support is not about money or new programs, but rather about strengthening the support of existing programs so that they can get involved and help indigenous communities across the state. Lorena Howwood is the executive director for Ama Du Alchini Bigam, a nonprofit based on the Navajo Nation that provides crisis services for victims of violence, including domestic violence, human trafficking, and sexual assault. ADABI is based in Chinle, but Howe said it serves multiple communities on the Navajo Nation. She has worked with the organization for nearly 30 years and is one of the few victim services on the Navajo Nation. It gets by with whatever funding it can get. Crisis is not going to stop, she said. The only funding ADABI gets from the start is from the Victims of Crime Act, which was established by the Federal Victims of Crime Act of 1984 and serves as a major funding source for victim services throughout the country. Howwood said they received $87,000 through the Victim of Crimes Act, covering two staff members, vehicle mileage, and part of their utility payments. She hopes to see more support available for victim services. Howwood advocated for increased state and federal resources for tribal law enforcement and victim services. "Our presence here is to amplify the call for justice," she said, "and to ensure that the voices of families out there are heard. Together, we can advocate for real change in our communities," Howwood added. "We need everyone's help." Karen Bedoni from the Navajo Nation said on Tuesday that it's time for Indigenous people to stand up and represent themselves with the help of their state legislators. "We want to be represented and not misrepresented," Bedoni said, "because often Indigenous people and their issues are swept under the rug or forgotten. We are on the back burner of everything that is happening here," she said, adding that it took the death of Emily Pike for any action to be taken. Bedoni said her goal is to work with the representatives and push forward so that the turquoise alert system makes a difference and does not fade into the wind. And with that, we conclude this story. Republican legislators call for more solutions to the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis. As we were recording on Wednesday afternoon, this story broke. Mayhem as ICE officials arrest multiple people at immigration court in Phoenix. Detainees believed their cases had just been dismissed by a judge after federal attorney agreed. By Paul Ingram of the Tucson Sentinel, May 21, 2025. Federal agents arrested multiple people at the immigration court in Phoenix on Tuesday, creating a situation one attorney described as mayhem, as people believing their cases had just been dismissed were taken into custody outside. Isaac Ortega, a Phoenix-based immigration attorney, said several agents arrested his client at the court after his hearing on Tuesday morning. The officials wore masks and refused to identify which agency they worked for, insisting only they were federal officers. Ortega said the unidentified agents took his client into custody and sent him to a processing center in Phoenix. It was unclear Tuesday night whether his client will be taken to an immigration detention facility in Eloy or Florence, or sent to one in another state. Video from outside the court shows several agents milling around a few unmarked vehicles, many with their faces covered. "My client has no criminal history. He entered the U.S. through the CBP program," Ortega said. He added his client was preparing for a credible fear interview, the first hurdle as part of the asylum process, when federal agents grabbed him from the court. Under federal law, immigrants have a year to file and pursue an asylum claim after entering the U.S. ICE officials refused to comment on the arrest Tuesday evening. Deportations at lightning speed. There were reports of agents detaining people after their hearings at other courts across the country on Tuesday. In Los Angeles, ICE agents sat in a courtroom to notify other agents in the hallway when a case was dismissed, an immigration attorney said. The move is likely intended to move toward deportations at lightning speed, she said. Since January, the Trump administration has sought to make immigration arrests a priority, enlisting not only special agents with Homeland Security investigations, a part of the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement, but also agents with the U.S. Marshals Service, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the ATF, and the FBI. In recent years, FBI agents have led, quote, welfare checks on families who took in minors unaccompanied by parents or guardians at the border, and DEA and U.S. Marshals made arrests at a Home Depot in Tucson in late January. During a four-day operation in Washington, D.C. this month, more than half a dozen agencies targeted dozens of businesses for inspection and made 189 arrests, ICE said. Officials have repeatedly argued this shift has not put hundreds of other federal cases investigated by these agencies at risk. Ortega said his client is a Venezuelan man in his 20s who came to the U.S. last fall through CBP-1, an application which allows immigrants to request an appointment at border crossings and go through a background and security check before starting the first steps to seek asylum. The program was managed by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which limited appointments to just 8 border crossings, including Nogales, the only Arizona-Mexico border crossing accepting appointments, and allowed around 1,250 people per day across the entire U.S.-Mexico border. CBP later revamped the program, calling it a, quote, deportation tool, dubbed CBP Home. The agency also began offering $1,000 for people to agree to return home, a plan advocates called a trap because leaving under the program means a 5 or 10 year ban on returning. Biden administration officials said the application was part of an effort to incentivize non-citizens to use lawful, safe, humane, and orderly pathways and processes. DHS encourages migrants to use lawful processes rather than taking the dangerous journey to cross unlawfully between the ports of entry, which also carries significant consequences under the United States immigration laws, Biden administration officials said in December, noting the appointments helped CBP process migrants in a more efficient and orderly manner while cutting out unscrupulous smugglers who endanger and profit from vulnerable migrants. From January 2023 through December 2024, more than 936,500 people, including Venezuelan, Cuban, and Mexican migrants, scheduled appointments through CBP-1, rather than risking their lives in the hands of smugglers, CBP said. However, the Trump administration slammed the door on CBP appointments, canceling every appointment on January 20th. Some migrants were already inside the Nogales border crossing when their appointments were canceled, and federal officials decided to hold them and send them to a detention center in Eloy. Trying to do the right thing. For my client, it's been frustrating, this type of ping-pong from one part to another, Ortega said of the man taken into custody Tuesday. He said his client was issued a court date called a notice to appear after he was released by CBP under CBP-1 and stayed under parole. However, that was undone by Trump administration officials who attacked the parole program on April 8th. Linda Toxlayowski, the president and co-founder of Immigration Defenders, said in Los Angeles, ICE agents inside immigration courtrooms began detaining people after government attorneys moved to dismiss their cases. There were 2 ICE officers inside the courtrooms who would notify the officers sitting in the hallway when a case was dismissed, she wrote on social media. It appears the government attorneys were moving to dismiss cases where people have been in the U.S. less than 2 years. By arresting them post-dismissal, they will now try to put them in an expedited removal proceedings and move toward deportations at lightning speed. Aaron Reichlin Melnick, senior fellow with the American Immigration Council, said there were similar reports in San Francisco, Las Vegas, and Seattle. Karen Tumlin, director of the Justice Action Center, criticized the Trump administration's move at the time, writing the revocations will cause needless chaos and heartbreak for families and communities across the country. The administration's targeting of this successful and popular process, one of the last remaining safe and lawful pathways, is reckless, cruel, and counterproductive, Tumlin said in a statement. The administration is breaking a commitment the federal government made to the hundreds of thousands of American sponsors and beneficiaries who did everything the government asked of them to participate. Following that move, Ortega said his client received another notice to appear. Tuesday was his first court date, and he was trying to do the right thing, Ortega said. During the hearing, the attorney with ICE agreed to close the case. After the hearing, federal agents detained his client. Ortega said this maneuver was likely an attempt to ensure his client's hearings were gone, making it easier for Trump administration officials to detain him and place him in an expedited process for removal. They always want people to enter the right way, to follow the process, but how are people supposed to do that when the rules are getting changed, he said. The Trump administration has made Venezuelan immigrants a prime target. Earlier this year, the White House stripped temporary protective status for around 350,000 Venezuelan migrants, undermining President Joe Biden's 18-month extension. While immigration rights organizations garnered a temporary reprieve from a federal judge, the Supreme Court disagreed and allowed the program to end in a Monday decision, Courthouse News reported. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem called Venezuelan immigrants, quote, dirtbags, and insinuated with no public proof that they were members of the street gang Tren de Agua. The administration has also sought to deport 176 Venezuelan men to a brutal prison in El Salvador, arguing that they can be removed under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. Ortega said his client was not protected under TPS because he entered through CPP-1. Ortega said he didn't see how many people were arrested Tuesday morning because he was focused on his client, but another attorney told Ortega the arrests were, quote, mayhem, just outside the court. She later told a fellow attorney she was shaken to her core by the arrests. Citing concerns about her clients, the attorney describing the scene declined to go on the record with the Sentinel. For years, ICE officials were deterred from making arrests and conducting interviews or searches at sensitive locations, including schools, churches, and courthouses, without an imminent need or clearance from supervisors. However, Trump administration officials revoked the Obama-era guidance and said ICE officials may engage in civil immigration enforcement in or near courthouses where they have credible information that leads them to believe their quarry will be present, and where such action is not precluded by local laws. And we're out of time, so this is all we have for mayhem as ICE officials arrest multiple people at immigration court in Phoenix. That's all the time we have for this week's edition of the Arizona Mirror, brought to you each week by Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Lauren Vicker, your volunteer broadcaster, thanking you for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week. Stay tuned for more great programming from Sunsounds of Arizona. And have a happy Memorial Day weekend.